Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart, writer, artist, and very funny person. Abby Jacobson is half of the creative duo behind the hit Comedy Central show Broad City. She's written and illustrated 4 books, having gone to art school. You can enjoy 2 of her skill sets in her new book, I Might Regret This, Essays, Drawings, Vulnerabilities. The thing she might regret is a solo cross-country road trip in search of some space and time to reflect on life's biggest questions along the way. Let's take a listen to a preview of the book in a video Abby posted on her Instagram.
Driving across the country from New York City to Los Angeles. There's no money in the budget for music, cause music is very expensive. So I'm singing the song, cause I made this video and I like it a lot. Oh, don't worry, I'm not driving this fast. I sped it up on my computer in a very cheap editing program that came with my laptop, baby. Boo, boo, boo. Yow, yow, yow.
Yeah, it made me laugh when I found it yesterday.
Oh, my gosh. I was like, what preview are you playing?
That's awesome. Abby, welcome to the studio, by the way.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I will say, I made this time-lapse video, and like, we had no budget for music, and music is very expensive.
I'm aware.
I gotta sing it, I guess. I gotta sing it.
It's so great because you can see the road in front of you, and it's just your voice. And
it's just, yeah. I had Marquee Moon by Television.
Oh.
To the video, and yeah. I had to sing it, you know.
welcome, by the way.
Thank you.
How was your trip, your road trip?
It was great.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a really necessary and incredible trip I took.
So people are probably wondering, why did Abby drive across the country for 3 weeks? By yourself, you had a heartbreak.
Yep.
Why did you decide, people do things like they dye their hair after a heartbreak, they switch apartments. Why did you decide to drive across the country?
We had just wrapped season 4 of Broad City. So Alana and I had like finished editing season 4 and I left basically the next day. And I did that because I needed to be in LA in 3 weeks. So I had work in LA 3 weeks from that time. I could have gone on a more traditional vacation with friends and just truly tried to have fun. But I don't know. I needed to be by myself and have that space. And I think I had been heartbroken for months, but I was in the middle of production for Broad City, so I couldn't really process any of it. And I needed to kind of like get away from anything that was part of my daily routine. And I'd never done it. I'd never driven across the country. And so I just went for it.
It's amazing how when you're having a difficult time, you can just put something in a compartment in one part of your brain, and then you do your work. And then when the work's over, it comes out of its compartment.
Exactly. And I knew it was like a looming compartment open. I was like, I gotta get out of here.
So when you hit the road, did you know you were going to write down everything? Did you keep a diary? Did you make just videos to remind yourself? How did you work on your writing process?
I knew I was going to write about the trip in some way. I kept a journal, and I wrote on my computer in like a journal kind of way, in different documents, on like digitally. And then I kept a little sketchbook, but it wasn't until after I got back and sort of processed the trip that I was able to figure out the framework of the whole book. So I didn't write any complete essay on the road because it just felt like that would have taken over the actual experiencing of the trip. But I took notes and tried to observe as keenly as I could.
So to the title of the book, the first part of the book is all these things that cross your minds, things you might regret about this trip. Can you share a few of the ones that came to mind?
That, like, what's the worst that could happen?
Worst that could happen, yeah.
I mean, this is my first foray into essays. I write scripts a lot, and jokes and dialogue, but I had never written in this format. So one of the worst case scenarios, which, fun to talk about today on the day it comes out, is that it just, people will criticize it that it was written poorly. Or that as I over and over, that my vocabulary isn't sophisticated. I think it, or, you know, I write about...
You adapt to eating only fast food on the road and become someone who advocates this new lifestyle.
It was really hard to find healthy food in the middle of the country. It's hard to find a good vegetable. So that was a fear.
I become a car fanatic. I become the young Jay Leno.
Yeah, because I mean, I drove a lot. I drove for a while. This is also about my first relationship with a woman, and I was that's what I was heartbroken about, that relationship. So jokingly, I was not half jokingly, you know, worst case scenario is that that somehow affects things, my career. I don't actually believe that to be true. I actually think it will make my career better. I think it should make one's career better, but that was in there as like just a little bit of a fear. Mm-hmm. I think being so vulnerable and not being hidden behind a character is pretty scary. I don't think I regret it though. I mean, we'll see. It just came out.
Call me
I
next
just
week.
Don't think I do though. I feel really good about it.
We're speaking with Abby Jacobson about her new book, I Might Regret This, which comes out today. You mull over what you call the big questions, and they range from sort of the hilariously mundane about my best friend's wedding. You wonder how Julia Roberts gets to be this top food critic by the age of 27, because we all know what we were doing at 27.
Exactly.
Right? And to the deeper ones, like why do people hate women is one of the questions you ask. Are these kind of questions always rolling around in your mind? You just didn't have time to put them down anywhere?
I think I put a lot of them down into Broad City. You know, that's where mm-hmm. a lot of my observations and thoughts tend to go. But when you're driving, I mean, the framework of the book, there's a lot of these drives. So I list, you know, New York City to Asheville is like almost 12 hours. And the drive essays are sort of, when you're driving by yourself for so long, you're listening to stuff and the illustrations are a lot of the soundtrack, but these drives are sort of examples of the way in which your mind wanders. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I started thinking about like, what are these big questions, extremely mundane to significant? Like one of my favorites is, do we ever stop feeling like we're 18? Because I just don't really feel like a grown up yet. But yeah, they're a little bit of ramblings and letting like stream of consciousness, but also important stuff, I think, that I'm kind of always thinking about.
You end up having, I've done a lot of road trips, you end up having sort of conversations with yourself.
Yeah.
I have this idea of, what do you think, self? Well, I think this.
Oh, yeah, you get in it. You realize that you have a lot of differing opinions within yourself about everything. Which is, yeah, I mean, I think it felt so luxurious to me to be able to do this trip. Like, I'm very aware of the fact that I also, like, got to write a book. It's a lot. Mm-hmm. But if you have an opportunity to just, I think traveling alone is something everyone should try, even if it's for a night. It's such a good experience it allows you to know yourself so much better.
But you do have some advice about that. You ended up in a bed and breakfast in Asheville.
I did.
And you thought you were kind of going to an inn like the Gilmore Girls, and then you realized the reality of going to a sweet bed and breakfast by yourself?
Well, I think an inn is probably similar, but I don't know. I got into Gilmore Girls late, and it was so charming, and I figured Asheville's full of these verandas and B&Bs, and it's bed and breakfasts are primarily for couples. They're really a couple zone. And I was single and pretty heartbroken and realized in the space I was already staying in. So you live and you learn, you know? It was interesting.
It's not also, it's bed and breakfasts aren't necessarily for chatty New Yorkers. I'm going to make a broad generalization there.
I mean, it's very, that essay it talks about how charming I thought it would be. And then the realization when I was there was that, you know, I don't even like a lot of people. Like, I'm not someone that would go and just pick up a conversation with anybody. Yeah, I don't know why I went to that.
How did you pick your towns?
I wanted to go the southern route because I really was interested in like the Southwest especially. And so I knew I would go that way. I knew someone in Austin. I knew someone in Marfa. And then other than that, I knew someone in Asheville. But I was actually already going there. And then I figured out I knew someone in Asheville. I don't know. There were a lot of the towns I'd never been to. And like Santa Fe, I'd never been to. Always wanted to go. Same with Sedona and Utah. They're just places that have always been on my list.
Mm-hmm. They're also all very beautiful
places.
They're
beautiful and so different than New York. You know, I've been here like 12 years now, and I'm so used to the noise that, I mean, I need a noise machine to like on my phone to sleep.
That's hilarious. You actually show which part of the app you use every night.
Yeah, I use this app, Brainwaves. And I can't sleep without it now. But then you go to Utah and it's so quiet that it is unbelievable to me. I just wanted that. I wanted to be in nature.
Did you have things specifically you wanted to do in each town? Because you know you go to Austin, you know, music town, got to have this kind of food. You go to Sedona, so, you got to have your aura red, your chakras aligned.
I got the aura red.
I know.
You know,
that's such a sweet, sad chapter. I'm not going to give anything away.
But I mean, that chapter gets me when I read it. I'm like, oh, Abby. I've had some time away. But, you know, the food thing was really interesting. And music, those are such social. Like, I live by myself here and I eat by myself here a lot. But when you're traveling, this like food is so celebratory, and so many people, I felt it most with barbecue. So many people were like, you're going through Nashville, you're going to Austin, you gotta get barbecue. I don't really eat a lot of meat, but I was like, okay, I'm here, I'm gonna do it. And then I went in to a barbecue place in Nashville, and I just felt, I can't eat this by myself. Like this is a shared meal. This feels wrong, and like this is gonna make me more sad. So,
right. You need somebody cued across from you to say, oh, your barbecue sauce on your face.
It's just like such a social meal. And same with music a little. Yeah. I felt a little insecure about going to see and do like that kind. It was just such an internal trip. I didn't, in the end of the book, I get into like a little bit of an insecurity that there's no huge culminating event that happened at the end. But that was sort of what I needed, where it was like, it's okay that I didn't do what everybody talks about doing in all the cities. I did like exactly what I needed to do.
We're speaking with Abby Jacobson. Her new book is called I Might Regret This: Essays, Drawings, and Vulnerabilities. And you're not afraid to look inward and on this trip reveal things about yourself, which you realize, wow, I was really not a good person in this situation. You write a lovely chapter about your mom. And you everybody should write a chapter about their mom like this. It's really lovely. And how, not that you were mean to her boyfriend, but that you were sort of aggressively indifferent.
Yeah, I mean, my parents got divorced when I was 13, and then they both were dating other people, and I was switching houses every week, and they were very much in my space. And I was like 15, 16, angsty teen that I wasn't outwardly mean. I just don't think I was ever fully like accepting or myself. I was just, yeah. And I went to Jerome, Arizona, because my mom's boyfriend that she was engaged to died of an aortic aneurysm when I was a senior in high school, kind of right in the middle of my indifference there. And they had gone to Jerome, that was like their favorite town, and he had bought me this ring. And my mom gave it to me the Christmas after he died. And I wear it, I've worn it every single scene in Broad City, except when Alana was wearing my clothes, she wore it. But that was like the one when I set out, I was like, well, I know I'm gonna go to Jerome. What's the route? And that just meant so much to me because when you look back at times in your life, you're like, why couldn't I have just been a little bit kinder? But then I'm also like, I was a teenager. I think he knew that.
It sounded like you had to go to Jerome in some way.
Yeah, it was a big closure moment.
There's also this really interesting part of the book called Working Woman, and you talk about how you just work, work, work. You love to work.
Yeah.
You know, taking 3 weeks off is sometimes hard for somebody who likes to work as much as you do. Did you have workaholism at all? I mean, did you find you going through withdrawal when you're on the road? Like, I must be working.
Oh, I mean, I was. I was doing a podcast here. We were producing it. I was doing all the notes on the road. And also, the road trip, in quotes, the vacation, I had already sold a book to, that was the only way that I could go on a vacation, was if I sold a book about it, basically. So definitely, yeah, it's a thing.
So next yeah. evolution step for Abby is just a vacation at
just
some point.
Just a vacation.
Just a vacation.
We'll see. It gives me anxiety just thinking about that.
That's not how it works. That's not how it's supposed to work. We're talking to Abby Jacobson about her book, I Might Regret This. It comes out today. You talk about in this chapter, Working Women, things that you have learned now that you're someone who's in the workforce and someone who gets to be a boss sometime. And I'd love for you to read this from page 188. One of the things you learned is confidently saying no.
Yeah. Okay. Confidently saying no. Until recently, I've been afraid of saying no to things because for years, professional opportunities were few and far between. So I would say yes to almost anything. I'd take on every illustration project or acting or voiceover job, even if I was working for free. I was so desperately seeking any chance to say yes that saying no to a gig didn't ever cross my mind. But in the last year, I've been learning how to confidently say no. No for me now is all about making room for more yes. So, while it feels insane to decline an audition or even a rare project being offered to me, because I remember when I was yearning for anything, I'm maneuvering my way through this more thoughtful approach to what I take on. I'm getting older and I'm learning more about myself, and now I can say for certain that no, I don't think a hair commercial on the beach in a bikini is right for me. No, I do not want to audition for that Woody Allen movie. No, I don't want to be the unfunny best friend that's 1/4 of an actual human being. I'll pass on that. I go back and forth on things a lot, but it's comforting to know I've nailed down most of my feelings toward bikinis.
Are you going to do an audiobook?
There is one.
Oh, I was about to say you need to do an audiobook.
There is one. It comes out today, too. It's out.
That's a weird thing, reading an audiobook.
It is.
Because you relive it.
Yes, it was a lot doing that. I knew I would do it, but it was a lot.
What was your favorite part of the trip?
I rented a bike from my hotel in Marfa, which is a hotel of Airstreams in Marfa, Texas. And the sky in West Texas is unlike... Have you been?
I have been, yeah.
I mean, and I write about it. I didn't go to see hardly any of the art in Marfa, which is what it's known for. I was enamored by the sky. The sky is unlike any place I've ever been. And I just rode this bike all around town. And that was maybe my favorite part.
The illustrations are terrific and they're really fun and they help you sort of understand where you are and what you're thinking about as you're on the road. The book's really, it's a really fun read. I think actually it'd be a really great read for someone 10 years younger than you are.
I mean, that's kind of who I wrote it for.
Yeah. Before I let you go, I have to ask you, last season of Broad City, and that was a decision that you and Alana made together, right?
Yeah.
Why did you decide 5 years, we're good?
I think it was very bittersweet. I think that it's very much about your 20s or our 20s in New York. And I'm 34, Alana's 31, and we play younger versions of ourselves on the show, but it was very much about your 20s, and that time ends. You know, it could go on. I mean, it could go on forever, but we felt like it shouldn't. This is we love this show so much and have been so precious with every little part of it. It's so much our baby that we really wanted to end it when people still loved it and still kind of wanted more. And the way that we end, I mean, we finished production on Friday.
So, wow, recent.
Very
wow.
recent. I'm not quite processing that yet. And the way we ended it could not be more perfect. Like, I'm so proud of this show. We still have editing for 2 months, but I'm very, very proud of the way we ended it.
It's very exciting for you. Tonight, you have an event at Town Hall in partnership with Strand Books. Town Hall's on West 43rd Street, in conversation with Phoebe Robinson,
yep,
one of the Dope Queens.
Yep.
Should be a lot of fun.
WNYC family in there. You know it.
Should be a good time. Hey, it was really nice for you to stop by.
Yeah,
thank you so much, Abby Jacobson.
Me.
Talk to you like you're Abby Jacobson. Nice to have you by Abby. The name of the book is I Might Regret This, These Essays, Drawings, and Vulnerabilities. Your show, in collaboration with Alana Glazer, returns for its fifth season and final season early next year. And after the break, we'll hear from Alana about her new project that aims to explore the ways in which public policy affects and shapes our everyday lives. Don't go away. All of it will be back after the break. You're listening to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. And now it's time for our regular trip through the station's archives with WNYC's chief archivist, Andy Lancet. Today, Andy is taking us on a bit of a history lesson. News of the migrant caravan making its way to the United States got us thinking about another group of migrants who left their homes right here in the States, the Okies. Immortalized in John Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath, they left their homes at the height of the Dust Bowl and headed west in pursuit of a better life, where they too were mocked, vilified, and oftentimes turned away. Andy's here, and as always, he's brought us some tape, this time from an audio docuseries about the plight of these folks that aired here on WNYC. So remind us, where were these Dust Bowl migrants coming from, and where were they going to?
Well, they were American farmers, farm families, sharecroppers, largely from the Midwest and the Great Plains states like Arkansas, Kansas, Texas, and Oklahoma, a reason many were called Okies. And given the Great Depression, along with prolonged drought and massive dust storms that were blowing away the topsoil, thousands of them fled west to more productive agricultural valleys in California with the hope of a better life.
Enter Robert Sonkin and Charles Todd. Tell us who they are and what they did.
Well, Sonkin and Todd worked at City College in what was then called the Department of Public Speaking, what we might now say is Speech or Communications Department. And they had decided to spend their summer vacations, believe it or not, in 1940 and 41, recording songs, ballads, and meetings at the Federal Farm Security Administration camps set up for these Dust Bowl refugees in Central California. So here we have Robert Sonkin reflecting on their experience putting together the documentary for WNYC.
Those folks out there in the big migratory labor camps up and down the San Joaquin Valley knew more songs than you could shake a stick at. They may have been blown out and dusted out of their homes back in Oklahoma and Arkansas, but they certainly managed to salvage their guitars and their songs.
Can we hear some of those songs of the Okies?
Sure. The first tune we have is written by a migrant named Jack Bryant. And Sonkin and Todd spent a good deal of time with Bryant and his family, and they called this piece Arizona.
You people in Oklahoma, if you ever come west, have your pocket full of money, and you better be well dressed. If you wind up on the desert, you're gonna wish that you were dead. You'll be longing for Oklahoma and your good old desert bed.
Now, did they also record him singing with his wife?
Right, they have him singing with his wife, which I believe we have queued up next.
I know mother's heart is broken. Pardon you that untruth had been spoken.
Well, the whole family got in on it at one point, right?
For sure. I believe the next clip we have is Jack's four-year-old son taking some of the action away.
Little old Jack Jr. there.
Yeah, he's singing a traditional folk song, John Hardy.
Now, I understand the great musicologist Alan Lomax played a part in getting songs of the Okies made. What was his role?
Well, it was with Lomax's help that the project was underwritten by the Archive of American Folk Song at the Library of Congress. And they supplied them with a quote-unquote portable 50-pound Presto lacquer disc cutter for the job.
All right. While we're on the Lomaxes, we need to mention Alan's father and fellow musicologist, John Lomax, who actually had a radio show. What was Ballad Hunter?
The Ballad Hunter was a series of 10 syndicated folk programs that we have in our collection. And like Sonkin and Todd's documentary for WNYC, these shows were somewhat novel at the time because they incorporated original field recording. And what we have here is a sample of the type of music you'd hear on the show. Here's a recording Lomax made in a segregated men's prison in Sugar Land, Texas. The prisoner known as Clear Rock Platt.
Oh, baby, baggy too, oh Lord, and the horse is black, baby, and the bug is blue, sure enough, that's all right, darling, that's all right.
The Dust Bowl, courtesy of the WNYC Archives. Andy, thank you for the audio history lesson.
Thank you.
Just a reminder that our listeners can hear this material and so much more at wnyc.org/archives/collections. Andy, thanks so much. We'll see you next week.
Thank you. See you.
That's all right, darling, that's all right, baby. Way up yonder, darling, by the sun, Lordy. Girls all call me baby, sugar plum. Sure enough, that's all right, baby.
Our trip through the archives reminded us there's always been a narrative about the United States that you could come here to find a better life. The recent rub has been, does the current administration and its supporters welcome people who aren't native-born Americans? This brings us to the topic of nationalism. Yes, that's the word the President of the United States has been using recently. Here he is describing himself as a nationalist at a rally on October 22nd in Texas.
We're putting America first. It hasn't happened in a lot of decades. We're putting them first. We're taking care of ourselves for a change, folks. Thank you. I like that guy, but not that much. Not that much. But radical Democrats want to turn back the clock toward the rule of corrupt, power-hungry globalists. You know what a globalist is, right? You know what a globalist is. A globalist is a person that wants the globe to do well, frankly, not caring about our country so much. And you know what? We can't have that. You know, they have a word. It sort of became old-fashioned. It's called a nationalist. And I say, really, we're not supposed to use that word. You know what I am? I'm a nationalist, okay? I'm a nationalist.
Nationalism is on the rise, but not just in the U.S., worldwide. The term has become a catch-all sort of euphemism touted by politicians with agendas. It's a loaded term that has a different connotation at varying points in history. So what exactly is the definition of nationalism? On the phone with us to discuss is Adam Serwer, staff writer at The Atlantic, covering politics. Adam, welcome to All of It.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. I want to just kind of start with a very basic level. What are the origins of the word nationalism?
Well, it originates in the 19th century as, you know, sort of all these countries in Europe are developing their independence and becoming and wanting sort of liberal democratic governments or rebelling against their old monarchies or whatever. But in the context of the United States, you know, obviously it has to do with the American Revolution and stuff like that. But American nationalism basically has two wings. I would say that it has an incarnation that is rooted in the idea that America is a white Christian country, and that's what makes it good and unique. And there's a different one that is rooted in the idea that anyone can come here and be an American. Give us your tired, you're hungry, you're poor. You know, being American is about a creed. It's not about a particular cultural or racial background. And I think both of those have essentially been with us since the beginning. You know, the Declaration of Independence said all men are created equal. The Constitution said slaves are three-fifths of human beings. And I think those dueling impulses have been at war with each other basically since the beginning of the country. But when Donald Trump says he's a nationalist, I don't think he means the kind of nationalism that is on display, you know, with the Emma Lazarus poem at the bottom, that's on the plaque on the Statue of Liberty.
by itself, without any politics, let's just sort of think of it like absolute signs, like you used to have in math class, without any politics or preconceived ideas about others attached to it, is nationalism at its heart a negative thing, or is it an idea and a concept that can be used negatively?
I mean, I don't know whether it's, I mean, it sort of depends on your philosophical perspective, but the idea is just like, the idea of nationalism is just, you know, the promotion of a particular, of a particular state, a particular country, a particular people, and it can be negative, as we can see with something like white nationalism, or in my view, it can be positive in the view, in the sense that it's expressed by American civic nationalism, where, you know, we're all Americans, we all have rights, and it doesn't matter where you come from or who you are or what your name is, as long as, you know, you are, you know, committed to the same creed that everyone else is.
I sort of remember from all of my history lessons that to get a sense of the dangers of nationalism, you need to look to World War One.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, obviously World War One, Europe degenerates into a massive war that is very much about the borders of particular states and who controls what. And I think in the United States, you know, there's a real surge in nativism that comes around World War One. I mean, the country was full of German language schools. People don't generally remember this, but there was a huge German immigrant population in the United States, and it was full of German language schools, and they basically all got shut down because of anti-German sentiment. And what sort of happens with wars like this is whenever there's a big war, there is a surge in nationalism and a surge in nativism. But what happens after the war is often the people who are targets of that nativism, the new immigrants who have just recently arrived, who are the targets of suspicion, they get assimilated into the broader population, and they sort of become accepted as citizens. Now, that doesn't happen with everyone. It happens most often with the Irish after the Civil War, with German Americans after World War One, with Italian Americans and Jews after World War Two, and I think it happens most easily with immigrants who are white presenting. But there is sort of you can see sort of those two nationalisms working together in situations like that.
We're speaking with Adam Serra, staff writer at The Atlantic, who's been covering politics and covering this issue of nationalism in the United States for a better part of the past year. So last week, the president, we heard that clip, described himself as a nationalist. He was asked by Laura Ingraham on Fox News to follow up. I'm just going to read a couple of things he said. He said, "It means I love the country. It means I'm fighting for the country. I look at two things, globalists and nationalists. Our leaders have been more worried about the world than they have been about the United States. I'm proud of this country, and I call that nationalism. I call it being a nationalist. I don't see another connotation in that. Now, as soon as you make a statement nowadays with political correctness in the world, they make a big deal. I'm not a globalist, but I want to take care of the globe. But first, I have to take care of our country. I want to help people around the world, but we have to take care of our country, or we won't have a country, including we have to take care of our country at the border." There's a lot to unpack in there. First of all, why does he keep saying globalist? And what is the dog whistle of globalist?
I mean, so a lot of people, when they hear globalist, they hear echoes of the anti-Semitic canard that Jews are disloyal and have other loyalties other than the loyalty to their country. But I would say Trump's explanation here for why he's a nationalist is basically political gibberish. Like, he's just saying, I care about America and my critics do not care about America, which is fairly typical fare. His choice of language is, I think, distinct. Saying he's a nationalist, but insisting that it has nothing to do with race. And I think, you know, it's one thing for him to say that, but I think when you look at his policies, it's rather clear that the president has a racial conception of who is a genuine American citizen. You look back at the remarks he made about African and Latin American countries, calling them, you know, it's something that obviously I can't say on the air. You look at his, you know, his comments this morning about wanting to repeal the birthright citizenship clause of the 14th Amendment by executive order. You look at his sending, you know, more troops to the border than we have in Syria because he wants them to point their guns, I guess, at a group of unarmed migrants who won't be here in for weeks. I mean, I think the president has, you know, he instituted a ban against travel ban against mostly Muslim countries. He, you know, has instituted a practice of separating children from their families, undocumented children from their families, in a way that has diverted resources from prosecuting even drug cases at the border. I mean, the president very clearly has an idea in his mind about who is an American, and that influences his nationalism. And I think it's disingenuous for him to suggest that that's not the case. But I think, you know, saying one thing and doing another is something that, you know, this administration has is a pattern of behavior that this administration is engaged in quite frequently.
Well, I think the president's view, and probably his supporters' view, is that no, we're just expressing extreme patriotism.
Yeah, but the problem with saying you are expressing extreme patriotism is that if you exclude people who are themselves also Americans because of their country of origin, that's not very patriotic. It is a kind of nationalism, and it's a kind of nationalism that has existed in the United States since its inception, but it's not one that includes people who are, you know, different. And I don't think, personally, I don't think that, I think it's antithetical to the ideal American creed. It's certainly not antithetical to how America works in practice.
We're talking to Adam Serra, staff writer at The Atlantic. We're discussing what nationalism is, what it has meant, what it means now in the world of the Trump administration. You know, you listed off all those news items that have happened in the past weeks and months, actually past 2 years, you did the whole laundry list. The one thing that you didn't mention was the election of Brazil's new president. Bolsonaro, the headline read yesterday in The Washington Post, Bolsonaro, hard right nationalist, wins the presidency. It isn't just here. It's happened in Austria. The BBC has a map that shows how nationalist parties fared in places like Norway and Sweden. What do all these places have in common?
Well, I think there's no question that there's a resurgence of particularly right-wing skepticism of democracy. People want someone who's a lot of these voters seem like they want someone who doesn't have much regard for laws and restraint on state power in terms of pursuing the things that they want that person to pursue. I think there are so many factors here that it would be difficult to say that there is one overriding thing that's driving all of this. I think the trends are particular to particular countries. Mm-hmm. I think Bolsonaro, you know, before... But in Brazil, when you think about it, it's a little strange because the left-wing candidate who was arrested and had to drop out of the race, he was leading. So it's hard to say whether Bolsonaro is an expression of a sense of, like, growing authoritarianism in the world, or if it's particular to this particular country where the more charismatic political candidate simply beat a less charismatic political candidate. I think when you look at the rise of Donald Trump in the United States, there are particular unique factors that led to his rise. I mean, it's not a coincidence that the president who followed the first black president of the United States is a guy who questioned whether the first black president was born here. So I think in every country, you really have to look at, like, these unique factors that lead to a particular candidate being elected. But I also want to say, you know, as I said earlier, what distinguishes the nationalism of a Donald Trump is not, his nationalism is different not because his opponents aren't nationalists. I mean, I think the Democratic Party represents very clearly a distinct kind of nationalism that is different from Trump's. But when he says, I'm a nationalist, or when we talk about candidates who are nationalists, I think we're actually talking about a different quality in their approach to government, which is their tendency to draw a line around certain people within a particular country and say, these people are good and those other people are bad, and I will use the state to punish those people who are bad.
We've been speaking with Adam Serra, staff writer at The Atlantic. If you get a chance, check out Adams piece. It was from last year, but it's good reading considering what's been happening in the past week. It's called The Nationalist Delusion. Adam, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Stay with us here at All of It. Alana Glazer will be up after the break. Welcome back to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. By now, you know that Alana Glazer made her name in Broad City, the web series turned Comedy Central hit she co-created along with co-star Abby Jacobson, who was the first guest on our show today. But lately, Glazer is embracing her role of activist and storyteller. She's the co-creator of the Generator Collective, which says it wants to inspire Americans to engage in the democratic process by sharing their experiences. The Collective's live Generator series is midway through a four-night Get Ready for the Midterms run at Murmur Theater on Eastern Parkway in Brooklyn. And Alana Glazer joins us. Hi, Alana.
Hi, Allison. Thank you so much for having me.
Sure, of course. Can you describe a Generator series? You say it's in all the literature and all the website and everything I read that it's a movement to humanize policy through storytelling. Can you tell me what that means?
Yes, and to be really honest, we're still figuring out what Generator is because we started as just a digital movement to encourage people to use Instagram to talk about policy and humanize policy, get it into our regular conversation, into our feeds. You know, I'm all for hot vacation bikini pics or whatever, but then let's pepper in, sharing our views and our experiences on how policy affects our everyday lives. Because I don't, you know, I'm not familiar with policy until it comes out in this disaster or something like today, what we're hearing about this new potential immigration policy. And Generator is trying to make it part of our normal conversation because we who founded it grew up in the 90s when don't talk about politics was like an actual saying back then. And we feel like that's what has gotten us to this divisive point in our nation's history. But the live series has sort of sped up or progressed what we're understanding about our movement. And I interview politicians and activists and learn how each role is meant to serve the people and where that's failing in a lot of cases.
Well, let me ask you about that. I'm going to separate the two different things, the online part and then the in real life part. The online part really, like you said, it really relies on social media. And you want people to tell their stories about policy. Well, we're going to play an example for our listeners. This was something that somebody uploaded to the Generator Collective Instagram page.
A policy that I'm very concerned about was recently one of Trump's executive orders took away from public land, and I'm very concerned about preserving national and state parks. I've never been more proud to be an American than when I'm in a place as beautiful and as well-preserved as the nation's natural beauty in these lands that belong to the public and are maintained for the enjoyment of the American people and the visitors who come from all over the world to see how great we are. So keeping those lands protected and the wildlife and the landscape protected is very important, and I don't think that that should go away.
There are a lot of those stories. Yeah, it's really neat. So what is it about personal stories you think breaks through?
I think our culture is increasingly recognizing narrative. And as we are all now have this platform, it's like when I was a kid and making like comedy videos or whatever, mm-hmm. It's not like everybody was making comedy videos. Everyone makes a video now. Everyone takes a video on their phone every day, you know, and Instagram is, with Instagram stories, it like makes it easy to have these snippets. And I think that personal stories are what make anything land, you know, to hear about dreamers. And I've heard about dreamers. I remember when Obama was president, like dreamers, this conversation about it, but not until there's a policy against them trying to control their bodies, essentially, that the policy lands with me. And not until I hear a personal story of, I came to this country when I was a kid and I was 8 years old. I didn't have a choice, but man, I contributed to this culture and I don't want to leave. America is now my home. That's when that policy lands with me. Policy feels so unattainable and sort of like my hands are like above my head up here. You know, it's like, it's too, I don't get it. It doesn't register with me, but when it can be distilled down to one person's human experience, their narrative of one life, that's when I think it is understandable, and when people don't think so much, I think when we hear these personal stories, individuals are more likely to vote for the people and to protect their brothers and sisters in this country than when it's like some headline on a bill.
We're speaking with Alana Glazer. You know her from Broad City. She's also the co-creator of the Generator series, the Generator Collective. I think it's interesting that you've keyed into this, because I know when they have people go canvassing with various parties or campaigns, they tell them to tell a story, not to talk about the policy. They tell them a story, because that is actually pretty much the way you will shift someone's opinion, which I think is really interesting that you've kind of caught on to this.
I'm lucky enough to be a storyteller for my work. So I've had this opportunity to like learn about myself and learn about the culture through my own personal story, or deriving from my story. And, you know, I look around, and the advent of smartphones, it's like we all have that power now. And everybody's always had that power. Everybody has a story, and everyone is able to tell it in their own way. But, and I think that's what Generator is saying, you know, share your story, because it's important, and it's what makes up America. The United States of America is 300 million stories.
Would you share a story that's important to you that is attached to policy? What's an example for you?
Lately I'm just like very focused on white supremacy, basically ending white supremacy. How can I contribute to this in my lifetime? Because I don't think it will be gone in my lifetime. But last night at the series, I had these three amazing politicians. Also, by the way, this Generator, the live series, you make videos at the event. And I mean, I'm just jazzed. I'm meeting these people, and they're incredible. Three local politicians from Pennsylvania, Summer Lee, Sarah Innamorato, and Elizabeth Fiedler. And we were all talking about policy last night. And like, there's no policy to police white supremacy. I guess that since mass shootings have been in the name of white supremacy for the past 2 years and have been increasing and have killed more people than what is called terrorism, I'm like, I think that white supremacy is terrorism that is, you know, really taking the lives and the bodies of so many people in this country. So I guess I would say gun reform. I think that, you know, the fact that people are killed, Black people and trans people and Jewish people and white people and in their churches and their synagogues, that one shooting should make gun reform laws immediately hit. You know, there should be common sense Sandy Hook, there should be common sense gun laws in place. The fact that the people are begging our government to stop taking money from the NRA, politicians, local politicians, from Trump to Lee Zeldin on Long Island, taking money from the NRA, it sucks. It's like you'd rather take that money and push, violence than protect the people.
So have you had a personal experience? Have you had a personal experience with gun violence?
No, I haven't. And that's something that you can also say in Generator Collective. I've never been in a mass shooting, but it scares me. And when you're in a movie theater, when I'm doing these Generator series in a stand-up show, when you're in a big place, that's a thought now. You know, that's a thought, like, shouldn't wear heels because I'm going to want to, like, be able to move if I need to. It's looming over me, even though I haven't been there. And I think that's how a lot of Americans feel.
So what's a typical Generator show like?
I basically explain Generator, and people, you know what, actually, I'll start again. People come in and they create Generator videos. There's booths and directors to help you create a Generator video. It's just four parts. What's your name? What's your name and how old are you? Where are you from and where are you now? What's something you enjoy and what's the policy that affects you? And some people are a little nervous. They don't feel confident enough yet to make a video, and some people jump in and do it. Mm-hmm. They come in and I have a I open up by explaining what Generator is, what our goals are, and then usually I invite either an activist or a politician up first, and I just interview them. You know, it's not like I'm not this some deep research interviewer. It's more just like human. I love to humanize these people. When I meet these politicians, I'm blown away that they're dedicating their lives to changing policy to better the country. And it's just like, how do you, you know, I even ask them, okay, yes, how'd you come to politics? But I'm also like, how do you chill? How do you, what are your boundaries for chilling and working when what you're fighting for is so important? How do you decide when it's time to have a glass of wine, you know?
a lot of it's really about
humanizing.
Before we run out of time, though, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we're going to run out of time, and I know you have two more shows. Who's on tonight's collective, and then who's on the next show? You've got good guests coming up.
Okay, so tonight is Susan Bicewicz from Connecticut, who is a lawyer, and I actually know her daughter, and she served as Secretary of State in Connecticut before, and two more activists tonight, Ari Berman, who's like the premier writer on voter suppression, and Anna Maria Archila. I can't believe we have her from the founder of the Center of Popular Democracy, also known as the woman who confronted Senator Jeff Flake in the elevator.
On Thursday, it is Amy Goodman. We're about to get out of time. Alana Glazer, thanks for joining us on All of It.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.